Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the Mini Break, your day podcast for the big storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Monday, May 6th. Only one topic for us to tackle on today's show, and that is a fantastic championship weekend in Madrid. We got the sort of finals, the sort of battles we had been searching for all event long, in particular on the men's side, a tactical thriller between FAA and Andre Rublev. Yeah, it wasn't the most physical tennis in the sense the points weren't going 15, 20 shots long, but to see the way Andre Rublev adjusted on the return of serve, to see Felix Auger-Aliassime play dominant front foot tennis for the first time in what feels like a year and a half, so much to celebrate on the men's side, but the men's side is the furthest possible thing from the headline from championship weekend. We got to see world number one versus world number two, and oh my goodness, did it live up to the hype. Our current 2024 match of the year offered by that Madrid final, as Iga Swiatek puts another trophy on her mantle, captures the title in Madrid, does it in the most dramatic of fashion. 7-5, 4-6, 7-6, she knocks out world number two, Aryna Sabalenka. Of course, that was a final rematch from last season. And last year, you thought, man, no way. You thought there is no way this year's battle was going to top last year's thriller. These two managed to do it. And certainly to see Iga get through in that situation, particularly after facing match points on her way to that third set tiebreak, to see Sabalenka answer so many different questions surrounding her game coming into this event by making this run to the final, not only pushing Iga to 7-6 in the third, she got a 7-6 third set victory over Elena Rybakina in the previous round. So, yeah. This weekend delivered in Madrid. We got a lot to discuss here on today's show. Apologies that this episode is coming to you later. I don't know if Westhoff's going to post it late Monday night or early Tuesday, but I was also busy recording a bunch of different interviews throughout the course of the day. The Cracked Interviews podcast feed going to be booming this week as we do one of my favorite segments throughout the course of every season. It's 2024 NCAA Sweet 16 Press Row. I'm going to try and interview a representative from all 32 teams remaining in the college tennis postseason. Of course, I was also busy broadcasting rounds one and two of that action all weekend long. As such, I needed to take some of today to not only interview those coaches, but I also wanted to watch these matches in full. Highlights weren't going to do it for me. I got to watch some of it late last night, but again, I wanted to watch through everything, feel comfortable discussing the flow of each of these matches. So apologies for the delayed release of this episode, but again, it's not because I'm slacking, it's because we've been busy. NCAA Sweet 16 Press Row. Hopefully we'll have 32 new episodes available for you by the start of Friday's action, and then we'll have coverage of the Sweet 16 Friday, Saturday, on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. I believe we will have 12 of the 16 men's and women's matches. It's early action in Rome. There's going to be a lot of pro tennis going on, I know that, but come check out the college tennis postseason. You won't find enthusiasm, passion at any other level of the tennis world like it. A lot of fun coverage ahead on that horizon. I'm headed to Stillwater next week with Westhoff and the entire gang, but right now, let's focus on the action in Madrid. Again, a fantastic weekend of tennis. A thank you to all of you listeners for tuning in. A thank you to the support we get from our friends at Tennis Point, tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR50. The headline is clear. World number one versus world number two. Iga Swiatek versus Aryna Sabalenka. In my opinion, the best matchup we have in all of tennis right now. And yes, that includes Alcaraz Sinner. Yes, that includes Djokovic and pick your flavor of the month. Yes, that includes Sabalenka Rybakina, which, by the way, I think is emerging as a really fun rivalry as well. Coco versus Iga is fun in the sense that you just know Coco's next decade is going to be filled by can I get over the Iga horizon. But the tennis these two play, Sabalenka is, and all due respect to Lena Rybakina, who you could say a lot of the similar things about, but Sabalenka is just the foil Iga Swiatek needs, because to beat Sabalenka when she is playing well or near or at her best, Iga has to play well. And with all due respect to the rest of the WTA field right now, which I think is deeper and more talented than ever before, a lot of times when Iga hits that 90% gear, not even 100, but or maybe even 80, 85% gear, you all know the cruise control I'm talking about, first serve wide, or really, yeah, first serve wide, first forehand inside out on the deuce side, flat wide, first forehand behind you inside out, or backhand line, or backhand cross. She could do everything serving on that ad side, landing the backhand return early on the rise, beating you to the spot. You know the cruise control gear I'm talking about. That's not good enough against Aryna Sabalenka. And there were moments in this match, particularly in the first set. A first set, Iga Swiatek won 7-5. You know, she had some early opportunities, right? 1-2, 2-3 service games of Sabalenka where she was kind of working Sabalenka in that backhand corner. Sabalenka was up for the test. And you just can't say that backhand to backhand about just about anyone else. Like, yeah, on the right day, Noskova, Ostapenko, some of the others we've seen beat Alexandrova, who have beaten Swiatek over the course of the past year, like they can get hot and go backhand line and make life a little bit more uncomfortable because they're just striking the ball so brilliantly. But Sabalenka can weather the storm. I think that's a fair description in the backhand cross exchange. Like she just has the power. She just has the depth. She has the strength, not only from a ground stroke perspective, but in her legs to dig out of that backhand corner and, you know, not redirect. Because if you bail out and try and go backhand line in a backhand cross with Iga and you don't do it successfully, now you're on the run. Now she has all of the space in the world. She can go forehand line behind you. She can go forehand cross short angle. She can drive the forehand to set up whatever she wants to do with the next ball. And usually with that next ball, if she does drive forehand cross, it's going inside out. You're going back into that corner. She's just crushing you in these clay court patterns. Sabalenka not only generates enough depth and pace, to make Swiatek have to hold her ground in those backhand exchanges, she can beat Swiatek sometimes, not every time. I'd still take the Swiatek backhand, but sometimes she can beat Swiatek straight up in backhand cross-court exchanges. Obviously, Sabalenka plays the sort of power tennis particularly amplified by the conditions in Madrid where her serve, her plus one, she's just able to play on her terms. Yes, Iga was able to do what she is able to do, and we're going to get to the Iga side of the equation in a second here, I promise, but I just want to focus on what Sabalenka was doing well here first, because, again, yeah, I know she lost the first set to Beatriz Haddad-Maia, but this was the first time we saw Iga pushed all week in Madrid, and it's worth exploring. What is it that Sabalenka does that makes the world number one uncomfortable? And it's not a conversation we haven't had before. David Kane and I have it every time he's on the podcast, but the backhand cross in particular in this final stood out to me as one that in the past, I just haven't seen it hold up as successfully as it did. And then obviously the big thing for Sabalenka all week long, righted the ship on serve. Now in this match, the first serve abandoned her relative to other matches where she was at a 57.6% first serve percentage. That was her lowest of the week. Lowest of the week, even lower than round one against Magda Linette. But the opportunities were there for her to play plus one. And boy, whenever she got a middle third ground stroke, she didn't waste any time unloading on it. I thought the consistency of her depth, again, how she was able to hold Iga in the forehand corner, attack that Iga forehand return with real pace on the serve to at least try and generate something short. And again, Iga this week was ridiculous returning serve, and at least against Sabalenka. And I say this with very facetiously, she was held to just five breaks of serve on 12 attempts in a match that went 7-5, 4-6, 7-6. Holding Iga to just five breaks is a remarkable feat for Aryna Sabalenka, just given how well Iga was seeing the ball and striking the ball on the return all tournament long in Madrid. She can just play on her terms. That's what it comes down to, is what was so exciting about this match is you had two players, to some extent, kind of doing exactly what they wanted to do. Like, I think if you're Aryna Sabalenka, look, she had, three? Certainly two match points before the breaker. I don't think she had one in the breaker. I apologize if I'm forgetting it. So 2-3 match points, whatever it was. I mean, again, like, first of all, the plus one Swiatek came up with to fight off the second match point. I think it was at 5-6 in that third set. Oh, my God. You're just like, yep, we're playing some tennis now, because that is a bold forehand strike, the sort of bold forehand you need to hit against Aryna Sabalenka. And I suppose that's the perfect lead-in to the Swiatek analysis and that side of the equation. Once-in-a-generational athlete. And by the way, so is Aryna Sabalenka. Her combination of power, size, fluidity, creativity. Like, Sabalenka, the technique doesn't always look pretty. She is a good and willing volleyer. The swinging volley, moving forward. Yeah, sometimes she cuts across her body on the backhand when trying to slice the backhand volley as a short little angle volley, and that's literally what you're taught never to do from a technique perspective, but she gets away with it because she is so talented with the racket in her hand. Iga is just a monster, and I've said, I'm sorry for rerunning this bit, but, like, give me the backhand sliding mixtape, please, because you're not supposed to do that fluidly out of that backhand corner. And, look, Iga's serving this year at a clip she's never served at before in her career. She's holding serve now through 4 legitimate months of tennis, and what, Iga Swiatek now here is 75-10. 75-10 over the last 52 weeks. We don't talk enough about that. She's 32-4 this year, though. So that's a 36-match sample size. That's legitimate. And she's holding serve 82.2% of the time. Her accuracy with her plus one was exceptional because she had to keep pace with Sabalenka from a first strike perspective. And when I've gotten frustrated with Iga's level at times this year, it's because she's hit herself out of matches, especially in that Noskova match, the struggles against Collins in the Australian Open. That's the particular matches that stick with me. Alexandrova just caught fire in Madrid, in Miami. I don't know what you say about that, but it feels like, and Rybakina was just lights out in Stuttgart, but it feels like at times in the rushed matches, that's exactly it. Iga's been rushed, that she's felt the pressure to match the plus one aggression of players who obviously have to come out swinging if they want any attempt at beating her. But this match is why she's played those matches, because she had to stick with her plus one tactic. Trying to play 75% neutral ball with Aryna Sabalenka on this day when she was swinging so aggressively, when she was connecting so well on the backhand wing, that wasn't going to work. And Iga picking every spot on the forehand for plus one cross, plus one inside out, which I think is her favorite of the forehands. We wax poetically enough about what she does on the backhand wing, but that was in full effect as well. She's a good volleyer, not a great volleyer, but a good volleyer. Like, great volleyer in the sense, I'm trying to think of who's a great volleyer right now in the women's game, who's the perfect example to turn to, where it's just like, yeah, the touch, the feel, the finesse, like, the technique is pure. You know the sort of volleyers I am talking about in the game. That's not Iga Swiatek. She's not pure feel and pure touch. But she isn't. Like, volleying is not, I want to be clear. If the answer is she good or bad at volleying, Iga Swiatek is good at volleying. It's just like, she's just always in the right spot. She always picks the right volley to hit. And she always does the right thing from a technique standpoint, from her technique to execute it. Now, it just, again, it feels a little bit more mechanical than maybe some of the natural volleyers that I'm thinking of as I tried to allude to this discussion. Like, I mean, I think about a Stefano Tsitsipas or like the Roger Federers of the world over the years, who, again, like, when they just kind of open their face on that backhand volley, you don't even notice a difference in their technique, and yet the volley does exactly what they want to do. Like, that's not Iga. She has to change her technique, right, when she hits the drop volley, and yet always changes the technique correctly. I'm just saying, like, there are levels to this game, right? And in that, Iga's level is only very good, not once in a generation. Like she is with the movement, like she is with the backhand, like the return, the hold percentage is starting to look like. I mean, she just made every right choice, and the plus one was at a level of consistency that I haven't seen from her before. And again, if that's the gear she decides to hit to counter the counter of the Sabalenkas and the Rybakinas and the Ostapenkos of the world and everyone who knows, all right, we just got to come out swinging and try to take cuts and take balls early down the line and redirect, and I'd rather go down missing than let Iga yo-yo me across the court. And I'm not saying Iga didn't do that, by the way. I mentioned how good Sabalenka was backhand cross. Iga was still pushing her in every sense of that, and Iga rose her level, and Iga was able to recover and dig back out of corners, and Iga was clearly the more fluid of the two movers. Iga was clearly the one who, when things broke down and she had to play improvisational defense, she was clearly the more comfortable of the two doing so. But 9-7 in a third set breaker between the world number one and the world number two, two players who are clearly the two best players in the world, as good as Elena Rybakina has been. And last week on this show, I made the case her resume is now at the table, on the table of the world number one discussion and the people who have it. And, you know, again, by force, I suppose, I've injected myself into that conversation. This was a win Iga needed, because I'm not saying she hasn't won titles. Again, 75-10 over her last 52 weeks. Like, during that stretch, she's won Warsaw, Beijing, Doha, Madrid, Indian Wells, United Cup final, shouldn't count in on the tennis abstract, but does count, Cancun, and Roland Garros. But during those runs, like, who have the wins been over? Yeah, the Doha final over Rybakina. I think that counts as a signature victory, though. Rybakina won Abu Dhabi before, you know, the week before. Indian Wells over Sakkari. Everyone in the field but Iga and Sakkari weren't playing their best, so that was a good win, but Sakkari's not a Tier 1 player and certainly wasn't playing Tier 1 tennis. Pegula in Cancun, again, the big thing was she beat Rybakina, Sabalenka in the semis. Like, that was the big win for Iga. But this was the first Tier 1 in a final win we've seen from her since Stuttgart last season, when she beat Sabalenka in that final. And obviously, again, she was going to be the favorite going into Roland Garros, even if she lost this final 7-6 in the third, even if she got broken and lost it 7-5 in the third. She's won it twice in a row. She's won it three times in her career, and she's only getting better. Iga will be the favorite at Roland Garros until or unless someone new and crazily talented emerges. Like, she's earned that benefit of the doubt moving forward for at least the next, we'll say, half decade. At least the next half decade at Roland Garros. I'm leaving the runway because there's a lot of talented young players who I'm just not going to write off yet. This was a Tier 1 signature, beating a Tier 1 player when they're playing very well sort of result for Iga Swiatek. And again, I'm not saying she hasn't been good against good competition. Iga's been ridiculous against all competition. I'll say it again. 75-10. She's won 88% of her matches over the last 52 weeks. She's made 7 different finals and is 7-0 in those finals. She's made 10 different semifinals during that stretch of time as well. 14 different quarterfinals during that stretch. And, you know, again, looking for her, the only events over her last 52 weeks where she didn't make the quarterfinals or further: Miami this season, Australian Open this season, and I think that's it. That's your list of events over the last 52 weeks where she hasn't made the quarterfinals or further. 75-10. She's not playing 50 matches. She's not playing 60 matches. She's not playing 70 matches. She's played 85 matches. She's 75-10. You look for her now during that stretch of time against top 20 opponents. Leads all players 23-6 during that stretch of time. You look for her against top 10 opponents now 13-4. Leads all players during that stretch of time. 82.4% hold percentage so far this year. Just, again, ridiculous for her. 47.5% break percentage, top three on the WTA Tour, and it feels like she's slacking because she's not flirting with the 50% number that she has over the last two seasons. Iga's playing really well, and here's the best part. She's going to have to sustain that level, because you look for Aryna Sabalenka now overall 46-16 over her last 52 weeks, but 20-6 now here overall on the 2024 season. And, you know, again, during this stretch, she's made 6 semifinals or further consecutively at the majors. You have Elena Rybakina, who is 53-13, 80% win percentage over her last 52 weeks, 30-5, 86% win percentage so far this year. And again, a player who has made the quarterfinals or further at every event she's played except for the Australian Open this season. The best players in the world are all playing their best, and we saw that on display in Championship Weekend in Madrid. Again, I didn't talk about the final, semifinal 1-6, 7-5, 7-6 win that Sabalenka desperately needed, and that confidence you could see on display and how freely she was swinging against Iga. Rybakina's 5 losses this year Alexandrova, who also beat Iga, is Alexandrova the fourth best player in the world right now? Some scholars are arguing maybe her ceiling is that high. Alexandrova, Blinkova in that really weird 22-20 third set breaker in Australia. Iga in the Doha final, but she won Abu Dhabi the week before. Danielle Collins in Collins' 16 or whatever match win streak. And Sabalenka 7-6 in the third. Still, Swiatek, Collins, and Sabalenka have been three of the other top five players in the world so far this season. Those are three of her five losses. That's how good you've had to be to beat Elena Rybakina, or you've had to be Alexandrova the week after she's won Brisbane, or Blinkova in just that weird Australian Open match. Like, we know who the three best players in the world are. It's been a while. I mean, like, I guess last year you knew it was Swiatek, you knew it was Arena Sabalenka, you knew Coco, Jessica Pegula, but there was a lack of clarity. Who's three? Who's four? I guess Coco during the second or the final third of the year was clearly that number three, maybe even number two. But man, like, I guess my thing is, as well as they were playing, this is world number one tennis from three different players on tour. And, you know, again, you look at the rankings, like, Sabalenka just turned 26. Iga's 22, Rybakina's 24. She's currently four in the world behind Goff, but you look at the points race, obviously, she's sitting at two right now behind Swiatek. They are playing that. They're all playing that well. And knock on wood, heading into Rome, heading into the French Open, they seem healthy as well. And that's all we can ask for over the next week. If that means they have to withdraw from round of 16 quarterfinal Rome action, so be it. I want to see these players healthiest at the French Open because they are certainly playing their best. We were treated to a fantastic final. And once again, it's Iga Swiatek who emerges from that final and emerges from the scene as, dare I say, pretty clearly the best player in the world. But man, and not pretty clearly because, well, clearly, but not very clearly because Sabalenka's playing well enough to beat Iga on the right day. Rybakina's playing well enough to beat Iga on the right day. I mean, we've seen that over the course of the past year from each of them. Big win for Iga. Needed that one from a confidence perspective. A tier one win. And again, that Madrid title, another trophy, a new one that she hasn't seen before to add to her mantle. Championship weekend was awesome and certainly lived up to the hype on the women's side. Was a really fun match tactically on the men's side. Was a little bit repetitive because a lot of big serves, a lot of big plus ones, but it's better for tennis when guys like Andrei Rublev and Felix Auger-Aliassime are playing their best or are certainly feeling confident enough mentally to at least get closer to playing their best tennis. And we talked about it all last week, but the biggest thing for Andrei Rublev was just his first serve came back to him here in Madrid. He made no less than two-thirds of his first serves in every single match that he played. Final was no exception, 67% in a 4-6, 7-5, 7-5 win over Felix. Rublev broken twice in that match, both of those breaks coming in the opening set. You look for for Rublev in the semifinals against Fritz, 4-3, made 75% of his first serves in that match. Yeah, the second serve was an issue, and Fritz was swinging real big on his return of serve. That's definitely a tactic. Felix took into the final against Rublev as well. First set, oh my, I can't remember if I've ever seen Felix hit his forehand return that well on a clay court, but you know what doesn't matter? A 40% second serve win percentage when you're making three quarters of your first serves as Rublev did against Fritz, in that semifinal, an hour 12 minute 6-4, 6-3 win for Rublev, and that plus one heaviness of ball just making life impossible for opponents who are constantly shuffling their feet and constantly in fear that Rublev's going to go behind them and just the weight of that shot pushing them backwards in the court. That was Andrei Rublev all week long. He didn't play exceptional tennis. He just played well. He served well. Made first serves. Kept things simple. Didn't combust beyond belief after dropping opening sets against Alcaraz, against Felix, and you know, again, Felix was so good in the opening set, especially, again, building out that 4-1 lead. Every forehand he touched was magical. And again, these conditions in Madrid, perfect for guys like Felix and Rublev, whom the ball flies off their racket. But man, again, just watching Felix take every return inside the baseline, watching Felix put so much pressure on Rublev early in the point, he played elite. Not good, not great. Elite tennis coming out of the gates. And by the way, should have. He was so well rested. Didn't have to play his quarterfinal match. Played six games before Lachechka was forced to retire with injury in the semifinals. And obviously, that was extraordinarily disappointed because Felix was playing well enough to beat both of those guys with how well he was serving all week long. Made 68% of his first serves in the final and won 71% of his first serve points. Now, won only 36% of the second serve points and down the home stretch in particular. It was an issue for Felix just if he couldn't be on his front foot, if he couldn't establish the pace with his first forehand, if Rublev was able to find his backhand with pace successfully. Obviously, again, that gets back to Rublev doing the simple things well and executing the things he does best and, dare I say, putting enough returns in the quarter, more so than Felix down the home stretch, to out-execute him and get those breaks he needed in sets two and three. But, you know, again, the biggest shift in this match, Rublev took away not the first serve, but he took away time from Felix. In particular, just saying, you know what? I'm going to stand on this baseline on the return of serve. And if you ace me or you hit one wide and you beat me to the spot and you get a plus one forehand, well, that's too good. But if I'm 6 feet behind the baseline, as he was in set number one, Felix was killing him anyways. And so it was, look, I can't give this guy time because, man, again, I haven't seen Felix look that good when in rhythm in a year and a half, since the end of that 2022 season when he was rolling through Basel, rolling through Paris, doing all those different things. That's how well Felix executed. That's how well he moved. That's how confidently and aggressively he was striking the return. And Rublev said, hey, I'm going to try that. And to see Andre move forward and have the confidence to do so, to short hop some backhands, and even if they weren't the most perfectly struck backhands, great grammar, Alex, it was that he took that ball earlier. It was that he took that extra half second away from Felix to prevent Felix from cleanly shuffling his feet around the ball and cleanly getting a look at a first forehand. And again, it was a break of serve in set two, a break of serve in set three that separated these two guys. Rublev played well, and you haven't been able to say that about Andre in 2 months. And look, again, talk about revitalizing his season. You win a Masters 1000, the second of his career, that'll do that for you. And, you know, again, with the win, Andre Rublev now back up to number 6 in the live rankings. He's back up to number 5 in the points race as well, within 15 of Zverev, by the way. And, you know, again, he's within 1,000 points now of Zverev in the rankings as well. Zverev was starting to pull away at that number 5 spot, no longer the case. A massive week for Andre Rublev, by the way, his first title run since the first week of the season, when, of course, he won that title in Hong Kong, but his first final since then as well. And, you know, again, to beat this version of Felix. But beyond that, he gets wins over Fritz, Alcaraz, Griegspoor, and Davidovich Fokina. All top 32 guys. It's exactly what the doctor ordered for Andre Rublev. And by the way, I apologize because this is just shows you how in a college tennis mindset I've been. I forgot to read all the best Opta-Ace stats that come out of this. And thank you to our friends at Opta-Ace for providing, dare I say, the best Twitter content in the business. You look across the board. Let's start with the Andre Rublev. We got two from Opta-Ace. First, since the start of the 2020 season, Andre Rublev has 221 tour wins. Trails only Medvedev at 223 for ATP match wins. He's got a 72% win percentage over that stretch of time. So for a half decade, again, half decade, Rublev's won 70% of his matches, second in total wins only to Medvedev, so he's been a workhorse from a work rate perspective. He's been a top eight guy for a half decade consecutively now. I don't know about Hall of Fame, but certainly in the Hall of Very Good, that's where Andre Rublev has secured a spot. Since the start of 2020, only Tsitsipas has more ATP Masters 1000 event on clay titles than Rublev, who has two. He's on level with Djokovic, Alcaraz over that span. By the way, I want to read the IGA stats because they're laughably exceptional, as they always are. IGA now, with her victory in Madrid, only Chris Everett, Margaret Court, and Steffi Graf. Say that again. Chris Everett, Margaret Court, Steffi Graf, the only players with a higher ratio of tournament victories in clay court events in the open era than Iga Swiatek, 8 for 18. She's won 8 of the 18 WTA clay court events that she's played. Graf, Court, Everett, Swiatek. It's a good list to find yourself on. At 22 years and 338 days old, Swiatek, the youngest player to win 8 clay court titles since Arantxa Sanchez Vicario when she won Amelia Island in 94. Again, good company to find yourself when, since the format's introduction in 09, only Serena and Vika Since 09, again, only Serena and Vika in the last 15 years have won more 1,000-level titles than Iga. Her nine now equal Kvitova, Halep for third most on that list. She's 22 years old. Now, again, Serena gets shortchanged because 2009, the format switched. The era of Serena began in the 1990s. So, again, Serena a little bit shortchanged in this category, but Iga's going to be number one on this list, and it might happen maybe even as soon as the end of this season. And last, but certainly not least, we've got two more for you. Iga, the first player to win seven consecutive WTA finals since she won 10 in a row from Roland Garros 2020 to the U.S. Open 2022. Lol. 22 years old. Iga now has claimed tournament victory in 9 of the 29 WTA 1000 main draws she's entered. That is the best tournament win percentage of any player since the format's introduction. Better than Serena, who's at 26.5%, Clijsters 18.2%, Sharapova 16%, Barty 12%. She wins 31% of the Masters events she's played. I think the question is legitimate. Will she start racking things up at the rate Djokovic? Like, that's who she's chasing from the 1,000-level title. Because, again, it started in 09, so Serena's not the chase. I actually think on that one, the chase is Djokovic. The chase is Nadal, to see if she can get up there with those two, because certainly feels like the runway is there. A lot of fun update stats offered by what was, again, a fantastic championship weekend in Madrid, the sort of weekend we deserved. I know there's been a lot of conversation. Do these 2-week-long 1,000-level events drag on? I'll wait till we have a guest on to have that discussion. But again, massive week for Rublev. Massive week for Felix, who makes his first 1,000-level final, I believe, of his career, which, again, talk about unlikely circumstances for that to have happened. It's his first final since October of last year as well. I mentioned this, I think, when I was talking with DK, his win over Casper Ruud, his first top 10 victory for Felix since he got a victory over Holger Rune in Basel at the end of last season. But then before that, you had to go all the way back to Paris 2022 when he beat Tour Finals 2022 when he beat Rafa there, Basel. You know what? We're just going to leave all that stumbling in. This shows you I should wrap the show, but Basel that year, he beat Alcaraz as well. Anyways, Taylor Fritz, by the way, very good semifinal run with that run. Fritz back up to 12. Felix back up to 20 in the live rankings. Welcome back, Felix Auger-Aliassime. Sneaky 23 years old, but you have been missed, my friend. That said, that's your look at championship weekend in Madrid again. We will be back tomorrow to preview another 1,000-level event coming up this week in Rome. It's going to be a really fun stretch coming up. College tennis postseason, Roland Garros on the horizon, 1,000-level action this week. If you can't get excited for that as a tennis fan, you're probably not listening to this show. That said, thank you to all of you who do tune in. Of course, again, appreciate all of you and your support. A thank you, as always, to the support of our super producer, Daniel Westoff, for the of an editing job he does day in, day out, making all of our content possible. A thank you as well to the support we get from our dear friends at Tennis Point. Remember, it's tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15. With that said, for our fantastic super producer, Daniel Westoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, leave that in. I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say. That's the break, and we will see you all tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.